I want to bring this to our attention, but I want to also say that this is from Bishop Carlton Pearson's book, God is Not a Christian, nor a Jew, Muslim, or Hindu. And I had to challenge my images of God in order to heal effectively. So this type of deity that we will be discussing today is the God of the Bible. So I'm going to be saying that the whole time so you know which deity I'm talking about, because in religions, there's more than one deity. You have monotheism, they say one God. You have polytheism, they say many gods. So here we go. In the hands of an angry God, the biblical one. When we come to the God of the Bible from this perspective, we see that our ideas about the God of the Bible's supposed anger and rage are absurd. Does the God of the Bible kill, maim, and blame? Does the God of the Bible throw temper tantrums? Is the God of the Bible psychotic with serious anger management problems? Do we need the biblical Jesus to protect us from the biblical God, like a mother holding back an abusive father? If so, how is this God of the Bible worthy of our worship? The God of the Bible is not worthy of our worship. This confusing, frighteningly malign, yet supposedly benevolent male entity is a dangerous lunatic who needs to be locked up or given some professional psychological therapy. Yet the evidence of our experience with the transcendent does not suggest that. The frightening image that has been misrepresented to most of the world is not the God of the Bible of our hearts and hopes. It is our childish misperception of the God of the Bible. Yet, this idea retains incredible power. The word judgment comes from the Greek word crisis, K-R-I-S-I-S. We get our English word crisis, C-R-I-S-I-S, from it. The foremost crisis in Western religious consciousness is said to be God's judgment. We struggle constantly between the image of a biblical God of unconditional love and the image of a biblical God of eternal judgment and damnation. But of the two, most of us clearly prefer to dwell on the latter. I saw much of this after Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans in 2005, and I wrote an editorial in the Tulsa World. The recent disaster in the Gulf Coast states has put both America and the world on alert to the awesome independent power and volition of nature. It is important to note that neither Hurricane Katrina nor any other natural disaster is or was an act of God, as some would erroneously insist. I repeat, it is important to note that neither Hurricane Katrina nor any other natural disaster is or was an act of God, as some would erroneously insist. The hurricane itself was an act of nature. The breaking of the levees, which caused the terrible flooding of the city, was an act of human error and neglect. Again, neither should be considered an act of God any more than normal or even abnormal bodily functions would be considered an act of God rather than an act of nature. In Luke chapter 13, Jesus dealt with those who insisted a particular tragedy in his day was an act of God when he said, "Do you think that these Galileans were worse sinners than all the other Galileans because they suffered this way? I tell you, no. But unless you repent," meaning to rethink, "you too will all perish. Or those 18 who died when the tower in Siloam fell on them, do you think they were more guilty than all the others living in Jerusalem? I tell you, no. But unless you repent," meaning to rethink, "I say again, you too will all perish." Perception is the ultimate reality, but not necessarily the ultimate truth. If you perceive the biblical God as vindictive, vengeful, and merciless, then to you, God will always be just that, and this will become your pitiful reality. This is what he's saying. God is a good God, doesn't have or need to throw temper tantrums like a spoiled and undisciplined child in order to get God's way, or because God appears not to have it. We should not attempt to reduce God to such mundane human variables. That's what I wanted to say. I'll stop right there because what Bishop Carlton Pearson was talking about was the evangelical movement's, fundamentalist movement's angry God trauma complex. And he was addressing those within the evangelical movement, the fundamentalist movement. He was not talking to non-Christians when he made these statements. He was not talking to secular people. He was making these statements. In his book, he was addressing people who, as he would say, you're trying to please an angry God and appease a difficult God. That statement is directed at evangelical movement people and fundamentalist movement people. And this is also more of what he said. So what he said has helped me to understand that when he says our childish misperception of God, he was addressing, again, evangelical fundamentalist people when he said that, okay? And when he's talking about the transcendent, he was talking about how in reality, people often try to make God to be unloving and unlikable and unworthy of respect, because that is how human beings who were Bible writers depicted that said God. So Carlton Pearson is also addressing the misperceptions that the Bible writers had of God. He was basically saying that what they said about God in terms of God's being a rageaholic, angerholic, frustrationholic type of deity is inaccurate. And I would agree, because I do not think that God would depict itself in ways that can cause human rights movement members like myself to sound the alarms like there's no tomorrow. So here's what Carlton would say. I do think that we have remade God in our own image, casting it as rage-filled and violent, and that image is reflected back upon us in the world we have created. I think many Americans, especially right-wing conservatives and religious fundamentalists, Carlton Pearson was one of them at the time, thought that by putting George W. Bush in office and emphasizing family / moral values, God might have mercy on America and preserve us from God's inevitable judgment. He was talking about his evangelical fundamentalist thought patterns at the time. Now he's a Unitarian Universalist and he is not a Christian in the traditional sense. And he says that everyone goes to heaven, ultimately. So I wanted to clarify that. Then he says, this expected or suspected judgment wasn't averted. Even 9/11 happened on God's watch, supposedly. Allegedly, not to mention the worst national financial crisis since the Depression. We've been at war for years and lost thousands of soldiers and suffered more than 31,000 serious injuries. The eventual cost of the Iraq War is expected to be in the trillions. Evidently, the other side's Islamic faith has not necessarily saved them from the horse, their supposed righteousness should guarantee either. The only explanation many perceive is that the biblical God must be judging this sinful nation and world harshly, right? Wrong. We created this world and we created its crisis. As stated earlier, most evangelical preachers don't necessarily preach Christ, they preach crisis. They don't preach good news. They preach judgment. That also means they only preach bad news. They preach anger and retribution by God and reduce their congregations to shivering, terrified masses begging for forgiveness in the face of imminent damnation. This is abuse. Wars and natural disasters are not products of God, but of man or natural forces like wind and waves. To conflate or confuse them with some sort of judgment is an act of evil manipulation and paranoia. And there's more. And then I've also wanted to let it be known that I just could not see God the way that evangelical fundamentalists do. I decided that I will no longer look at God that way. Because for a while I used to feel, what if God was that type of God? Now, I decided that what I was taught about God wasn't true. And that's why I decided to be a Buddhist. I could not be a Christian anymore, and I will not be a Christian anymore, and I cannot be a Christian anymore. I'm a secular Buddhist. I do like this that Carlton said. Today, I assign you to freedom of thought, new thought about God and how you relate to divinity. Most of what we see today in our scientific material world is a result of someone's idea materialized. It is inextricably connected to the original idea and is not necessarily perfect, just evolved to its present form. Tables, chairs, light bulbs, automobiles, computers, the list goes on, are all lesser forms of more perfect ideas that have been reduced to materiality. So is the case with you. You don't have to be perfect to experience your inherent connection to God's original idea if you are a believer. If you're not a believer, it's okay to reject what Carlton Pearson just said in his book, okay? In fact, perfection is the last thing you should be seeking because it implies an end to growth. Instead, seek awareness and connection and evolution. Carlton Pearson says, I've been accused mostly by Christians of preaching a false gospel, but he then says that is untrue. I am preaching the original gospel, the one preached before religion corrupted it. The word gospel doesn't just mean message, it actually means from its Greek translation, good news or glad tidings. No, Carlton Pearson says, I am not preaching of the gospel, but Carlton Pearson says, but I am preaching another God, one different from the God presented to billions for millennia. Then Carlton Pearson says, I am preaching a new vision and version of God. This reimagined God is not mean and paranoid. God is not nervous and jittery. God on too much caffeine. God is not angry, vicious, and violent. God is not worried about the universe God created. And God has no plans to destroy it like a petulant child wrecking their tinker toy creation, meaning God, in this case, because it displeases God and starting over. This God 2.0 is more like the one Jesus preached about and attempted to represent more than represent in Jesus' day. As Walsh wrote in his book, most of humanity believes that God decides which humans are included in quote-unquote the Word. We humans then form groups or clusters around what we perceive God has decided, and we call them religions or faiths. God then supposedly, through God's Word, or our perceptions of God's words, allegedly, and I say supposedly because it's all up in the air, assures us that God will bring those he approves of back to God in heaven by telling them what is best for them. We then preach that what we perceive God to be telling us is best. Those humans who are not included in our perception of those chosen by God, supposedly allegedly, become them. They become the other, the adversaries. They will not, under any circumstances, be part of the elect that God brings back to heaven, nor will they be part of the chosen people if they don't do what is in accordance with what is best for the doctrine that we have created out of what we think God has said to us. So if you don't accept Christ, get baptized, and all the rest, you're certainly unworthy to be part of the chosen or loved of God, says who? I love that point. I love that point because I think that all of those things are made up by humans. None of those things are truly from God. And it actually helped me to let go of a otherism God, a tribalistic God, an elitist God, a favoritist God, a nepotist God, a cronyism God, a bigotry God, a discriminatory God, a human rights violating God, a human rights atrocities inventing God, a human rights abusing God, a war crime committing God, a crimes against humanity committing God, and a mass murdering God, a mass killer God, a spree killer God, a rampage killer God, a serial killer God, a genocidal God, a murder-suicide God, a misogynistic God, a misogynistic God, a racist God, an adult supremacist God, a xenophobic God, a Republican God, a Trumpist God, a white supremacist God, a greedy God, a materialistic God, a prosperity of God, a living large, all about Benjamin's baby God, a sex negative God, a homophobic God, a transphobic God, a biphobic God, a lesbophobic God, a non-binary phobic God, a heteronormative God, a heterosexist God, an abuse survivor phobic god, an atheist discrimination god, an Islamophobic god, an abortionist hating god, an anti-sex work god, an ableist god, those are the images of God I had to surrender and let go of. I had to let go of an abuser God, a traumatizer God, a victimizer God. So proud of myself for understanding that, as Carl Pearson said, but all dogma is just a human construct. I don't believe any of the myths that have already been busted about Christianity. That means that all the myths that are within the Christian religion, I reject them all. And so, as for obedience, living by constricted legalistic rules is not obedience to God, but to man proposing to represent God. For millennia, weak and impressionable humans across the planet have mistaken the words of the person who says they are speaking or writing for God and God's voice. With all due respect, Muslims who claim that they became suicide bombers because and an am told them that Allah told them to blow up the enemies of Islam are not on a holy mission. They are simply brainwashed into obeying authority without question. It is cultish and careless, ignorant and arrogant. The same would be true of a group of fundamentalist Christians who feel they are signed by God to bomb abortion clinics or antagonize gay youths and trans youths, I say, to the point of desperation and suicide. That is the danger of legalism. It's a tool of human power and human self-deception. If there were ever anything to be associated with what some call demonic, legalism is surely it. But if you obey church instructions or follow intrusive teachings out of fear of damnation or blind obedience to habit, ask yourself, who am I obeying? Chances are, it's not God. We don't need to be forgiven by God or accepted by God. That would be like you looking at your foot and saying, you need to walk 5 miles today for me to forgive you for tripping last night. I think legalism is especially dangerous to inclusion in the kind of unmediated knowing or experiencing of God that I'm talking about, because it makes spiritual life all about actions that take place in the outside world. Whether it means fasting, praying, studying scripture, observing Sabbath, those are important actions for some people, but make no mistakes, they are about human needs, not spiritual realities. Like labels, they are filters through which we allow ourselves to perceive a narrow slice of the spiritual whole. Theologian Kerry Harvey writes, legalism is to seek to achieve forgiveness from God and acceptance by God than obedience to God. But that statement is full of fallacies that represent the outmoded view of God that is tearing apart the world, as well as the lives of individual conflicted Christians. I'll read this last one. What is to stop us from interpreting that passage is the most, in the most generous way possible, as an exhortation to set aside the mission to evangelize and to quote-unquote teach neighbors something they innately already know about, namely God. From this perspective, which would completely shatter the evangelical concept of saving others and good riddance to it, no one is a spiritual scholar. No one's interpretation of the Bible or any other book, including this one, is superior to anyone else's. We all possess the secret knowledge, and only no secret, just forgotten. It is both sacred and secret, yet we all know it is in the deepest parts of ourselves and souls. Only our hunger for temporal power compels some to go on turning the phrases and books produced by men into eternal calls to arms, supposedly proclaimed by God. Overcoming legalism. Literalism is one sin or one evil. Faith-based people say sin. Secular people, we say evil. We must cast over the side of our spiritual ship. Now, spiritual for believers is of God. The word spiritual for secular people, we just say inner beauty or logic, as an example. Legalism is another. Legalism is a theological position that focuses on adherence to dogma, rules, regulations, and codes of conduct over all else, including love, grace, mercy, compassion, internal growth if you are a non-believer, and spiritual growth if you're a believer, and a personal relationship with the divine if you're a believer, and a personal relationship with inner beauty and logic if you're a non-believer. As practiced by the Pharisees, legalism was the principle behind Jesus' eventual arrest and execution. This is not necessarily an exclusively Jewish, racial, or cultural malady. It was a religious one. It was Pharisaic separatism, something most religions are guilty of, whether identified as such or not. Clearly, when we are trying to grow beyond petty, destructive practices of religion toward more pure spirituality or more pure inner beauty, legalism is a death sentence. Instead of inspiring the believers in a certain faith to follow certain moral precepts because they are central to personal spiritual development, personal inner beauty development, in Christianity they're supposed to include compassion, care for the poor, mercy, love, and justice, legalism simply demands obedience to the religion's rule book and thou shalt not prohibit actions. It is a deeply controlling philosophy that precludes free thought and self-interpretation of the faith tradition. Instead, seeks to perpetuate itself by making people dependent on the man-made system of the religious organization rather than the unfiltered deity. I appreciate those thoughts because so many people who are believers and even non-believers think these thoughts as well. And so that is why want to also admit that I'm a secular Buddhist. Secular Buddhism, sometimes also referred to as agnostic Buddhism, Buddhist agnosticism, agnostic Buddhism, atheistic Buddhism, pragmatic Buddhism, Buddhist atheism, Buddhist secularism is a broad term for a form of Buddhism based on humanist, skeptical, and agnostic values, valuing pragmatism, often naturalism, eschewing tribalistic central beliefs in supernatural, paranormal. That means the way that a lot, most believers define supernatural, paranormal, it's often a temporal exclusion and eternal exclusion of non-believers, which I do not subscribe myself to. It can be described as the embrace of Buddhist rituals and philosophy for the secular benefits by people who are atheist or agnostic or free thinker or critic of religion or skeptic or humanist or even deist. Secular Buddhists interpret the teachings of the Buddha and the Buddhist text in a rationalist and often evidentialist manner, considering the historical and cultural context of the times in which the Buddha lived and which the various sutras and tantras were written. The secular Buddhist framework strips Buddhist doctrine of various traditional beliefs that could be considered superstitious or that cannot be tested through empirical research, such as supernatural beings, such as devas, bodhisattvas, devas, nagas. N-A, and they put the accent symbol above A. Pretas, Buddha, etc., merit and its transference, rebirth, and karma. Buddhist cosmology, including the existence of pure lands and hells, etc. Traditional Buddhist ethical views regarding social issues such as abortion and sexuality may or may not be called into question as well, so some schools, especially Western Buddhist ones, taking alternative stances. Yeah. I'm open to soon or hopefully a day when supernaturalism and paranormal, anything and everything can be tested through empirical research. I just don't like the religious definition of supernatural and paranormal because it's always about God's accepted and God's rejected. I'm like, I can't live my life like that, and I will not live my life like that. I also decided I'm a Christ-like Buddhist. I'm also a universal Christ consciousness Buddhist. Here we go. Secular Buddhism rejects power structures legitimated by the metaphysics of Orthodox Buddhist belief. It questions notions of spiritual progress based on standardized descriptions from meditation practice, as well as the idea that Buddhist practice is essentially concerned with gaining proficiency in a set of meditative techniques endorsed by the authority of the traditional school or teacher. Instead, secular Buddhism emphasizes a practice encouraging autonomy and equally encompassing every aspect of one's humanity, as modeled by the Noble Eightfold Path, right view, right intentions, right speech, right actions, right livelihood, right efforts, right mindfulness, and right concentration. Such an approach is open to generating a wide range of responses to specific individual and communal needs, rather than insisting on there being quote-unquote one true way to quote-unquote enlightenment valid for all times and places. Key concepts and practices. Unlike the various kinds of Buddhist modernism, which tend to be modifications of traditional schools of Buddhist thought and practice in the light of the discourses of modernity, secular Buddhism is founded on a reconfiguration of core elements of the Dharma itself. To this end, it seeks to recover the original teachings of Siddhartha Gautama, the historical Buddha, yet without claiming to disclose what the Buddha really meant. Rather, it interprets the early canonical teachings in a way that draws out their meaning in the Buddha's own historical context. The culture of the Gangetic Plains in the 5th century BCE, while demonstrating their value and relevance to people living in our own time. Both aspects of this interpretation are literally, quote unquote, secular in that they evoke the Latin root word seculum, a particular age or generation. The ethos of the movement is captured in Stephen Batchelor's Confession of a Buddhist Atheist. Secular Buddhists propose metaphysical beliefs and soteriology of Indian religious culture be left behind if they are unable to be scientifically. This culture saw human life as an irredeemable realm of suffering from one which the culture saw human life as an irredeemable realm of suffering from which one should seek transcendence and an enduring beyond human condition, a stance that virtually all Buddhist schools towards Hinduism, Jainism perpetuate. Secular Buddhism, on the other hand, seeks to impart the Buddhist teaching as a guide to full human flourishing in this life and this world. Adopting a post-metaphysical philosophy, it parts company with existing religious forms of Buddhist orthodoxy, which have evolved since the Buddha's death. Instead, it aligns itself to today's post-metaphysical philosophy, not least phenomenology. So finding itself on a convergent path with similar movements in radical Christian theology found the works of thinkers such as Don Cupid and Gianni Bitano. Secular Buddhism has its roots in Buddhist modernism and secular humanism as part of the broad trend of secularization that has been ongoing in the West since the recovery of classical Greek culture and the Renaissance. Many aspects of secular Buddhism are associated with the abandonment of hierarchical features of Buddhist monastic culture among some lay Buddhist practice communities. In the West, during the last decades of the 20th century, favor of democratic principles of civic association and inclusion of women, disrupting traditional structures of patriarchal authority and gender exclusivity. The Insight Meditation Movement in the United States was founded on modernist secular values. Jack Kornfield, an American teacher and former Theravadin monk, stated that the Insight Meditation Society wanted to present Buddhist meditation without the complication of rituals, robes, chanting, and the whole religious tradition. Essen Goenka, a popular teacher of Buddhist the Passana meditation, taught that his practice was not a sectarian doctrine, but something from which people of every background can benefit an art of living. It essentially treats Buddhism as an applied philosophy rather than a religion, or relies on Buddhist philosophy without dogmatism. While recent scholarship has shown that such framings of Buddhist tradition were in large part rhetorical, and that teachers such as Goenka retained their traditional religious commitments in enacting their teachings and disseminating their meditation practices, such rhetorical reframing had a powerful impact on Buddhism was appropriated and repackaged in the context of the emergent globalities of the latter part of the 20th century. Stephen Batchelor is a self-proclaimed secular Buddhist who promotes a strictly secular form of Buddhism. Batchelor was a Buddhist monk ordained in the more traditional forms of Buddhism. From his experience as a monk practicing Tibetan Buddhism and later Zen, he felt the need for a more secular agnostic approach. In his books, Buddhism Without Beliefs, Confession of the Buddhist Atheist, he articulates his approach to Buddhist teaching, describes Siddhartha Gautama as a historic person rather than an idealized religious icon, and scrutinizes typical Buddhist doctrine dealing with the concept of an afterlife. In his book, After Buddhism, he founds a skeptical philosophical interpretation of Buddhism akin to the Hellenistic philosophical tradition of Parhanism. Batchelor suspects that Para learned some Buddhism while Para was West in India as part of Alexander the Great's conquest, and that Parhanism may reflect the skepticism of early Buddhism before Buddhism fell into dogmatism. I am a secular Buddhist. I'm an agnostic Buddhist. I'm a Buddhist agnostic. I'm an agnostic Buddhist. I'm an atheistic Buddhist. I'm a pragmatic Buddhist. I'm a Buddhist atheist. I'm a Buddhist secularist. I want to talk about Buddhism and sexuality. It's simple. It's really, 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 really simple, okay? We're in favor of tantric sex and sexual yoga. Now, there's a plurality of views when it comes to Buddhism and sexuality. It's the same thing in all religions. You have everyone in each religion having diverse interpretations of sex and sexuality. So there's not gonna be just one view. And it's unreasonable to think that there is. Like, I am open to the concept of God as long as it can be scientifically proven to be true. And I'm open to the concept of deities if they can be scientifically proven to be true. No, to the concept of Christ, Christ figure, as long as they are able to be scientifically be proven true. All right. This is more. That's what I wanted to mention earlier. Thank you all for being patient with me. So I also wanted to bring to our attention the importance of what my secular Buddhism is all about. One more article, okay? The Noble Eightfold Path. I teach one thing, suffering is in the Buddha. Introduction. The Eightfold Path is the fourth of the Buddha's noble truths and describes it as the way that leads to the uprooting of the cause of suffering and thus to increasingly stable and profound peacefulness, wisdom, virtue, and happiness. Each of the eight elements of this path is described by a word that is typically translated as right or wise. Both meanings are useful to reflect upon regarding your own suffering and yearning for its end. Each element of the path is right in the sense of being correct, moral, and a pointed instruction about how to live. Each element is also wise in the sense of resulting from deep understanding and leading to good results. In keeping with the weight of tradition and the value of the sharp edge of the word, right, that's what is used in the summary. While the eight elements of the path are presented here in the traditional sequence, there is not something developed in order. They're all important all the time, yet some may become more prominent aspects of your practice at one time or another. The heart of each element of the path is non-clinging, the essence of the third noble truth, the cause of the end of suffering. Note, quotations are shown in italics and in some cases have been edited for brevity, clarity, putting female pronouns, etc. Unless otherwise indicated, quotations from the Buddha are from Bhikkhu's Buddhibodhi's anthology. Bhikkhu Bodhi's anthology in the Buddha's words shown as BW with page numbers. Right view introduction. Right view entails a deep embodied understanding of the truth of things, in particular the truth of the three topics discussed just below. One who has fully developed right view is considered a stream enterer, one who is searching of ultimate liberation. The Four Noble Truths, the Buddha, and what monks is right view? Knowledge of suffering, knowledge of the origin of suffering, knowledge of the cessation of suffering, knowledge of the way leading to the cessation of suffering. Okay. The unwholesome and the wholesome. Right view also entails understanding what is unwholesome and avoiding it, and understanding what is wholesome and doing. What did the Buddha say were the causes of the unwholesome? They are any and all forms of greed, hatred, delusion, and belief in a separate self. What did the Buddha say were the causes of the wholesome? They are equanimity and renunciation, compassion, loving kindness, wisdom, and releasing the conceit of self. You might like to consider the causes of the wholesome and unwholesome as they occur, in your own mind and life. For example, you could take a day or a week and investigate one cause in particular, such as all the manifestations in the freedom of your mind, or alternately, all the manifestations of compassion. The chair of dependent origination. Last right view means understanding what the Buddha called the chain of dependent origination. In its essence, this means simply understanding that everything is the result of causes, like restatement of the law of karma. In personal terms, this means that if you foster certain causes in your life, good things will result for you and others. On the other hand, if you foster other causes, bad things will result. Wisdom is knowing which is which. In the formal detailed statement of the chain of dependent origination, the Buddha gave a complex, circular, intertwining, and sometimes mind-boggling description of why things are the way they are. This description can be daunting at first glance. Take your time with it and learn more about what specific terms mean that the Buddha uses. Its depth and power will become clear for you and probably very useful. This is the chain with 13 links. Taints. Central desire, ignorance, and sheer existence lead to ignorance. Not realized for noble truth, presenting a separate self, leading to volitional formations, wholesome and unwholesome intentions expressed with the body, speech, or mind, leading to consciousness, linked to the five bodily senses in the mind, leading to name and form, the cognitive and physical aspects of individual existence, leading to the six sense spaces, sight, touch, mind, etc., leading to contact. The meaning of three things: a sense organ, an object appropriate to that organ, and a consciousness associated with that organ. The five senses in the mind, there are six types of contact, leading to feeling, meaning, not emotion, which is a mental formation. But the tone of an experience is pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, leading to craving. Performs from mental phenomena, etc., leading to clinging. The sensual pleasures of avoiding pain, to abuse, to rites, R-I-T-E-S, for rituals, and a sense of separate self leading to existence among the realms of Buddhist cosmology, ranging from hells to heavens, leading to birth and reincarnation on those realms of existence, leading to aging and death, and then carrying karmic tendencies, which are taints. I think reincarnation is more about the legacy that you leave behind. There are repetitions and feedback loops within the chain of independent origination. That means you can change your fate at many pivotal links of the chain in particular. Reducing ignorance sends huge positive ripples to the whole system. You can have equanimity towards your feeling and reaction toward whether something is pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. You can interpret the tendency toward craving, clinking, etc. Right intention, introduction. It's sometimes translated as quote unquote right resolve, which conveys a determination, firmness of aim, heartfelt conviction, and persistence that are central to right intention. Intention of promises, this is a broad aim of not causing pain, loss, or destruction to any living thing. At a minimum, this is sweeping resolution to avoid any whip of harm to another human being. The implications are far reaching since most of us participate daily in activities whose requirements or ripples may involve harm to others. Example: use of fossil fuels that warms the planet, purchasing goods manufactured in oppressive conditions. Further, in American culture, there's a strong tradition of broad individualism, which, as long as you are not egregiously forceful or deceitful, let the buyer beware on the other side of daily transactions. But if your aim is preventing any harm, then the other person's free consent does not remove your responsibility. Taking it a step further to many harmlessness, means not killing bothersome insects, rodents, etc. if you don't have to. Even as you feel the mosquito sticking its needle to your neck. If you don't have to, get rid of the mosquito window, you know? And to many, harmlessness means eating a vegetarian diet, perhaps foregoing milk products since cows need to have cows to keep their milk production flowing, and half those cows are male who eventually be slaughtered for food. Okay, harmlessness has heart-centered interpretations. So harmlessness to one may be diverse harmlessness to another, all right? Nonetheless, we need to realize that there's no way to avoid all harms to other beings that flow inexorably through our life. If we are to eat, we must kill plants, and billions of bacteria die each day as we pass wastes out of our bodies. If we get hired for a job, that means another person will not be. But what we can do is to have a sincere aspiration toward harmlessness and to reduce our harms to an absolute minimum, and that makes all the difference in the world. I dare say that you have people who feel like that they don't cause animal abuse, and the only thing they do to animals is eat the food and nutrients. So that has to be factored in the harvesting discussion as well. Intention of non-ill will. Here we give up angry punishing reaction toward others, animals, plants, and things. The kind of anger and punishment that is self-absorbed and egocentric. If such attitudes arise, we resolve not to feed them and to cut them off as fast as we can. So to sum it up, because I think I'm gonna do an episode about this another time. Basically, I just want to give y'all a little bit of, I'll say this though. About this church experience I had. So I was in church and, seeing Pastor John K.K. You can see in the first batch which went on and telling his congregation in his sermon, interest in his cross, was talking about how something that is disturbing to me. That you have a lot of people come to the pastor for what for the wrong things, or things that they're not supposed to come to the pastor for. It could be trying to get the pastor to get them to sin. They may want to cheat on their spouse or leave their spouse for another person. And they try to get biblical justification of that permission for them. So Pastor Dickens may have to deal with. I read this passage before, but it's so important to say again. They're in this destruction, that God is their stomach, and their glory is in their shame, and reminds them of faithful things. Luke chapter 3, verse 19. So, a lot of people. I think I told this story before, but let me tell it in a different way so you'll appreciate why I'm bringing it up again. A lot of times in churches, they are so accepting of original sin that they do their best to sin like there's no tomorrow each and every day. And they claim in their hearts to have this utter hopelessness about, I can't sin, don't sin, but I can't help it. I'm born bad, I'm born trash, I'm born awful. You know, I have a reprobate mind, so there's no way that I could ever truly, really be holy. God, I'm only the best I can with this holiness concept that's in the Bible, but unholiness comes easy to me. So basically you're saying that unholiness is unnatural to you. What you're saying is also, holiness comes hard to me. This psychosis is getting worse and worse and worse. So you want the chief shepherd of the church building, who is supposed to be the most anti-sin, most pro-righteous person, you want that chief shepherd of the church building to reverse their pastoral role in terms of reversing that pastoral duty seat, meaning you want your pastor to be the most pro-sin and the most anti-righteous person in the church building. I had to leave church, man. I had to leave. I'm no longer a member of the First Baptist Church of Lenarden. And I'm no longer representing the Alphabet Baptist Church of Alexandria. I couldn't do it. Because COVID helped me to leave the church, so that's something good that the pandemic has done. It's easier, much easier for me to say I don't want to go to church and not actually go to church because, hey, the pandemic has not been called off yet. Professionals are still saying the pandemic is happening. So, that is why, even if church reopens, I don't go to church with my parents anymore. I let them know, and so we don't go to church together anymore. That's one of the advantages I like about being over the age of 21. So, you know what? Let me not rush. Let me make sure I cover the most important things. So, the Four Noble Truths. Let's quickly go over those, alright? Everything else I'll just put in the article link and let you know this is what I value. So let's go over the Four Noble Truths really quickly. Four Noble Truths are: life is suffering, the cause of suffering is craving, and the suffering comes to the end of craving. There's a path which leads one way from craving and suffering. What that means is, excuse me, what that means is often our cravings are craving the wrong things, the wrong people, the wrong situations, the wrong environments, the wrong things. A lot of times suffering is self-imposed. When there's suffering there, it's enforced upon you by others. It could be abuse and trauma, organizations that come in these things. Different types of suffering causations, alright? And I do want to say this last thing about sex. I will end with sex. Isn't that great? Is that abstinence from sexual misconduct. Obviously, this means not engaging in infidelity, rape, molestation, incest for monks and nuns. It goes farther, which includes touch, being loved by men of the opposite sex. Okay, same sex, etc. That's for monks and nuns, okay, because that's what they've chosen for their lives. So it does not apply to everybody else. There are also rounds of sexuality that involve shades of gray. For example, when is sexual exploitation involved? And seduction, even flirting. We often know in our bones if we are starting to cross the line which we're using at first for our own purposes, especially if there's an element of deception. But sometimes it's not so clear. How about cajoling or pressuring our mates for sex when they'd rather go to sleep? Is that misconduct? Or consider viewing mainstream pornography. If you believe that people and images are being exploited in some way, even if their participation is ostensibly voluntary, are you engaging in sexual misconduct if you participate in the exploitation by buying the magazine? Or simply clicking onto the website? Practice is about wrestling with these questions mindfully with a skeptical eye on the element of clinking, not robotically adhering to it some fixed rule. If there's any whiff of clinking, grasping, or aversion in the action, is probably best for it to supplies each of the elements of the Eightfold Path. And now, I'm going to conclude the episode. I want to say, that I am a person of secular spirituality. My secular spirituality is the adherence to a spiritual philosophy that adherence to a religion. My secular spirituality emphasizes the personal growth and inner peace of the individual rather than a relationship with the tribalistic interpretations of the divine. My secular spirituality is made up of the search for meaning outside of a religious institution. It considers my relationship with myself, others, nature, whatever else I consider to be the ultimate, which would be I love myself, animals, nature, insects, architecture, life, planet, earth, universe, etc. Often, my goal of secular spirituality is living happily / my helping others. I also want to say that what I was taught about religion was that you have a lot of people who have dirt on each other in the church. Pulpits and congregations have dirt on each other. Congregations have dirt on each other internally. You have congregations have dirt on congregations. Pulpits have dirt on other pulpits. Choir lofts having dirt on pulpits, congregations. Pulpits, congregations, and pulpits have dirt on choir laws. Choir laws having dirt amongst each other, amongst themselves. So you have congregations, pulpits, and choir laws who have dirt on other choir laws, pulpits, congregations. You have church leadership got dirt, other church leadership. You got church leadership got dirt amongst each other internally. And so I recognize that there is a culture of secrecy and double dipping and double living and double crossing, secret life living in the church. There's a lot of blackmail, emotional blackmail in the church. Threats, harassment, intimidation due to the blackmail system in the church. Got bad secrets in the church. So I say all that to say that I love being a secular Buddhist because secular Buddhism is about being an integrous person. It's not about having supernatural squabbles nor paranormal fighting matches.